Good. As always, the perfect warriors, thank you for coming. Thank you for coming to the show. And I welcome all the guys listening to the recording as well, and the girls, obviously. I think we're left with, I guess, seven lecture slots. Since yesterday, the CEOs ruled in this lecture hall. And I think we'll probably be able to cover everything that I intended to cover. However, not more than that, which is presumably also okay for most of you. Okay. So last week, we began our discussion on real-world networks. We also continued that discussion. And the point was that real-world networks tended to be orders of magnitude larger than toy examples from science, if you wish. And thus, we were interested in statistical properties mainly, okay? But statistical properties sounds a bit, well, like descriptive statistics only, which is not the case. So we're more after finding descriptive statistics that tell us something about the true architecture. And with architecture, I also include the generative processes that presumably are responsible for having generated those networks, right? So today we'll be looking at ways to kind of model these networks that go beyond mere descriptive statistics, okay? So, and with respect to statistics, what we had, what we discussed was, for example, mean average path lengths, clustering coefficients, degree distributions, and among that, the power law degree distribution was one that we were particularly interested in. Scale-free was another interesting term, or an important term. We were also interested in finding or saying something about maximum degrees, network resilient mixing patterns, as well as community and group structure, which is something that we already extensively discussed. Okay. As I said, navigability will be an issue in on next Tuesday. And component structure is also something that will concern us again today. Okay, good. So that was basically the descriptive statistics slots or the quantities that we may or may not be interested in. And we will see what we can do with that. So for the games engineering students, they are supposed to do or to work with these quantities at least partially in their third assignment. So it's maybe interesting to kind of read this very, very well-written survey by Mark Newman. So as I said, with all the background reading, most of the papers and most of the book chapters contain a lot more than we actually cover here in the lecture. So don't be misled and don't be kind of annoyed by the additional material in there. So for those of you that find this interesting, I think it's also a good reading there, right? But I think you'll be easily able to identify the corresponding sections that we actually cover. So good. What about the generative models, okay? So the simplest model for a network that you can imagine is a Poisson random graph, okay? So what's a random graph model? So a random graph model is a, well, probabilistic ensemble of possible graphs that is governed by some sort of probability distribution. Okay. And in the Poisson random graph, we have two parameters. So G and P denotes the ensemble or family of graphs with N nodes that are generated by the Poisson random graph prescription algorithm process, or however you want to call that. So out of the O of n square possible edges that you can have, if you have n nodes, out of these n square edges, each one appears just with probability p. So in essence, you're doing n squared Bernoulli experiments. Okay, so you just draw whether an edge is supposed to exist or not. Okay, and that's a very simple model, actually. And if we regard, so cursor, please appear. Thank you. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Good. So if we regard the number of hits that we get for a single node, or in other words, the probability that a node has degree pk, naturally, if you're doing Bernoulli experiments, you'd have a binomially distributed number of successes, or a binomially distributed number of edges that this node is connected to, right? So you're a node, and you have n other nodes, or n minus one other nodes, and for each possible edge, you decide with probability p whether this edge is supposed to exist. And the question is, how many hits do you get? And that's just a binomial distribution, right? So probability pk is n over k, p to the k, 1 minus p, n to the minus k. Good. So you know that binomial distributions are, at least with respect to their cumulative probability function, or with respect to answering questions in terms of how probable is it that k is between blah, 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 they're notoriously hard to handle analytically, right? So that's why people keep on approximating this binomial distribution either with a normal distribution, with a Gaussian, or with a Poisson distribution. And each of these approximations has its ranges where it's justified, okay? So for all of these approximations, they hold in the limit of large n. And that's the limit we're always interested in, because we want to rule out local effects that occur because, whatever, by chance we have a configuration like blah, 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 blah. This should be ruled out. So we always regard this n to the infinity limit. And if we keep the mean degree of a node, right? So the expected degree of a node would be p times n minus 1. Yeah, and that's the expectation of the binomial distribution, right? Just p times the number of trials that you do, which is intuitively intuitively understandable. If we keep this mean degree of a node Z fixed and go with n to infinity, naturally we would have to go with p towards zero. So we would have to regard the limit of small p and large n. Okay. And in that limit, it's perfectly justified to approximate the binomial distribution with a Poisson distribution, which looks like this, which you might know from probability theory. And that's why they're called Poisson random graphs. Okay. Now, the question is, what properties do these Poisson random graphs possess? And that's a very fundamental consideration. So one way to understand large real-world networks is to come up with such a random graph model, not necessarily as simple as a Poisson random graph, but some probabilistic model. And then you compute the descriptive statistics elements that we had in the beginning, so mean average path length, clustering coefficient, and all these other quantities. And if these coincide with the measurements from the real network, this is kind of a hint, or an argument towards saying, okay, I kind of understood something about the real world network, right? Because let's assume real world networks had all the properties of the random graph model. We could say, well, it's imperfect coincidence. So the real world network can be supposed to be just an instance that was produced by this random graph model. Okay, that's why we always keep on comparing these things. And another nice fact or another nice property of these things is that you can naturally do numeric experiments, right? So it's not necessarily to analytically solve something, right? Because we'll see that this is hard for more expressive models, but you can do numerics and then try to compare what actually happens. And as I said, and as the review kind of reflects, this is a very active field of research and one that has had really considerable success over the last 15 years, right? So a lot of interesting phenomena can be explained in terms of that. Physics has a longer tradition of investigating graphs or networks because in statistical physics, naturally, you would always have things like particles and interactions which kind of ask for something network-like. And then you would try to do or follow pretty much the same program, right? So a physical model would be a theory that explains natural phenomena. And that's just what we do. So it's no wonder that a lot of these guys are actually physicists, with some exceptions. For example, Duncan Watts, he's a mechanical engineer. However, still very successful. Good. So, however, if we have these random graph models, what we come across very often is something that you might call a phase transition. Okay, so first of all, what does it mean if we say that a graph out of G and P has some property Q? For example, that it is connected or that it has a mean average path length of X, Y, Z, I don't know. What we want as a formalization is that G and P has the property Q with high probability, means that the probability for Q giving some N and P goes to 1 if N goes to infinity, right? So that's more or less a formal way to grasp that. You don't necessarily need that. You can stick to my first explanations and they'll do the job for you, right? However, this kind of formal definition, I put on the slides in order to explain what I mean with phase transition or what Anna Lehmann and her co-authors mean when they review network phenomena and kind of define what they understand by phase transition. And that's the following. So we have a GNP model, right? And we assume a threshold function Q of N that goes to infinity if N goes to infinity. Okay. And in the limit of large N, this probability P of Q giving N and P, so the probability that the graph or the ensemble has a certain probability, is zero if this quotient goes to zero if N goes to infinity. Or in other words, if Qn grows asymptotically faster than Pn, okay? And it's 1 if the converse is the case, so that Qn grows less aggressively than Pn, right? So, and why is that a phase transition? So in a sense, this Qn kind of defines a threshold. And if certain things in the graph, certain properties, properties can be described as being below this threshold, then the graph does not have the property at all. Okay. And once we're only slightly above some limit, some threshold function, this graph has the property, right? So this is a kind of a discontinuous behavior in a sense. Yeah. And the term phase transition, as I already mentioned, was coined by physicists, and it's a very common phenomenon in statistical physics. And one of the prominent examples is, for example, melting ice, or the sublimination of carbon dioxide from the solid state to the gaseous state, right? And pretty much the same is true. So these systems as theories for something kind of have this discontinuous behavior, as has the natural phenomenon itself. Yes?
What was the function P of M?
So that was a P is the probability in the GNP graph model. Okay, and that's a function of n, since we want to keep the mean degree fixed. Okay, that's on that slide that you kind of missed. Okay, so P is the scalar parameter of GNP, which is just a scalar. But if we want to have Z fixed, if we go with n to infinity, naturally P must go to zero, so P must be a function of n. Okay? Good. Yeah. No problem. Yeah. So the question is, who wins the race? So P of n going to zero and Q of n going to infinity. Yes. Question is, who wins the race, right? Good. So one example of such a discontinuous behavior is the existence of a giant component. Or in other words, the question whether some instance of GNP is connected or not. And why is that interesting? Okay, and we'll see an example at the end of this lecture where we talk about percolation processes, and percolation processes we'll be talking about in the context of vaccination strategies for disease spreading or disease avoidance. Yeah? Because we'll see, and there are a lot of other practical examples, so in the context of communication networks, for example, it is of vital interest that any node can communicate with any other node. So if you have a large number of disconnected components in your network, you wouldn't have the property of this communicatability, if you want. The converse is true the opposite is true, I should say, for these disease networks, because you want to contain the spreading of a disease, right? So you want to keep it in isolated components. And this naturally has to do with the infection rate and other properties, yeah? So, for example, the most severe diseases that we can think of, like hemorrhagic fevers, Ebola and stuff, they are so aggressive in their infection and disease processes that people keep on dying too fast in order to spread that very far, right? So that's why these Ebola outbreaks are always so locally contained. Yeah, so everybody dies before he or she can transmit the disease. So that's something that's interesting, especially interesting in the 21st century, because we know that antibiotics keep on losing their effectiveness, and I think probably we'll be dealing with these phenomena a lot more in the future. So it is interesting to know whether a network does have a giant component or not. And how do we kind of compute that? And with these examples of the math, I just want to give you an insight into how people would compute quantities like that. It's just examples, right? So we're not trying to cover everything here. So if U is the fraction of nodes that do not belong to the giant component, right? And the giant component will denote as X for the moment. So in essence, this is equal to the probability of some node to be not in this giant component. Yeah. Do you agree? Giant component, not Star Wars. Doesn't make sense. Come on. It's 8 in the morning. You're kidding me. Okay. Good. So this fraction U, right, the probability for a given node to be not in the giant component, okay? What is that? So obviously for a fixed K, yeah, this is equal to the probability that none of the neighbors of this node is in X, right? If one of the neighbors would be in X, naturally this node would belong to the component, right? So U for fixed K is equal to U to the power K. And that U to the power K is just the probability that none of its neighbors are in X, or in other words, that all of them are not in X. That's why we have U times U times U times U, and this times stands for the logical and in probability theory, right? So the plus stands for the logical or, and the multiplied by stands for the logical and, right? So if we leave K variable as a variable, we would have to compute the expectation here, naturally, right? So we know that we have a fraction pk of the nodes that actually have a degree k, right? So if we want to compute U for a non-fixed k, we would have to compute this expectation. So the quantity is U to the k, and pk is the probability that we actually have k. And we'd have to sum this naturally from 0 to infinity since we're having a expectation, right? Now, fortunately enough for this GNP model, we know pk, right? Pk is just a Poisson distribution, and so we can just insert our pk, and it was here, that's our pk, z to the k e to the minus z over k faculty. And if we actually do insert this, what we find is that z to the k over k faculty, we can, in the numerator, we can kind of draw together this z and u because they both appear in the power k. So we'd have this, and this is just the series for the exponential function. Yeah, so you know this from calculus. So in essence, the result is e to the z of u minus 1, right? So that's the equation we have to solve. That's a transcendent equation. U is equal to e to the z times u minus 1. Okay, rather strange. But this is not analytically solvable, so you'd have to do this numerically. And it's maybe more convenient to kind of transform this. So if the fraction large S, or if S large S denotes the fraction of the graph that is occupied by X, right? So if X is the component in question, and it covers almost all of the graph, then large S would be close to 1. And in that case, we speak of a giant component, yeah? So it might well be the case that new nodes that kind of join the network are not yet connected or even form disconnected components. For example, imagine 2 or 3 friends deciding to join some social networking platform, and they register themselves, they kind of build profiles, and their first action will be to kind of add each other, right? So in this case, we might have an isolated triangle, but once they connect to some other person in the network, this triangle becomes part of the giant component. That's a typical process in social networks. Social networks are, on average, always connected, right? So you don't have to deal with isolated components naturally, right? So this S is just a convenient quantity. It's just 1 minus U, okay? And if you transfer this transcendent equation, U equal to Z, E to the Z, U minus 1, this is the result. S is equal to 1 minus E to the minus Z times S. Good. So that's okay. Now, nothing about phase transitions, just playing around with these numbers. Okay, good. Now, what's the result of this? Now, as I said, you would have to solve this equation numerically. And while doing so, you can also solve for the mean size of the smaller rest components. And it turns out that this is given by this expression here. We don't give a proof. If you want to kind of calculate this or want to see why this is the case, it's just working with the same methods, roughly the same methods. And that's the result, so the mean size of the smaller rest components. Now, if we kind of draw both quantities, namely the giant component size S and the mean component size bracket small s bracket, yeah, what do we see? And we draw them as a function of the mean degree Z, right? What will happen? Okay, so the mean degree is naturally a non-integer number, and we start with 0, 0.5, and so on. So if Z grows, naturally we expect the connectedness to grow, yeah, if nodes have more edges to other nodes, if they have a larger degree on average, things should be more connected, right? But conversely, so what grows is the mean size of the smaller rest components, whereas the giant component is still not there, okay? So if on average we're having a mean degree of 0.5. What does that mean? So only every second node has one connection to some other nodes, right? So it's really very, very, very sparse. But once we cross the boundary of Z equal to 1, meaning that we have slightly more connections than 1, and that's a very sparse graph, then very quickly the giant component size grows to 1. Okay, so if we're having a mean degree of 3, which is ridiculous for social networks, because in social networks we're talking about mean degrees of 100 or 200, right? Then we know that the giant component size is almost equal to 1, yeah, 0.9999999, right? So these are only these isolated new nodes that kind of make up small peripheral components, okay? And for physicists, this is a typical diagram that kind of is typical for phase transitions of that particular order. And why do I speak of phase transition? Okay, so between 0 and 1, we just don't have a giant component size. So it's equal to 0. And then very suddenly, there is an onset of this giant component size. So this function large S is not some smooth function. So it's discontinuous in the sense that it starts at 1, right? And that's comparable to something like melting ice, right? So if you have an ice cube, naturally this will melt gradually, but that's not what we mean. I mean, if the temperature is only slightly below 0, it will not melt at all. And if it's larger than 0, it will eventually completely melt. At least, let's say, if it's 1 or 2 or 3 degrees, right? And if the other physical conditions, pressure and so on, are accordingly, right? So this is a non-continuous behavior in a sense. So before degree 0, the lattice in that solid ice cube is stable, and then it suddenly becomes unstable, right? In a sense. Well, stability might not be the best of words to describe that. It is a phase transition, okay? And that's something that researchers interested in networks always find interesting, because these are phenomena in connection with networks that are hard to foresee or hard to manage in a certain sense, right? So imagine, for example, this disease spreading network. You're having things under control, bam, and you have the plague and everybody dies. Yeah? So that's kind of a discontinuous phenomenon that you have an interest to kind of foresee, control, manage, right? So that's why these things are important and interesting. Okay, good. Now, what about GNP then in general? So is it, we see that GNP kind of has this giant component almost for free. What about the other properties of GNP? What's the mean average path length, for example? Yeah. So what we see is that the mean degree of nodes is Z, right? So very roughly in a distance D from a node I, we should have approximately Z to the power D many nodes, right? And that's for a tree. So naturally in a graph, you would also have back edges, yeah? But very roughly, we can imagine that we have Z to the power D, right? And if Z to the power D is N, we mean that we have kind of taken into account all the nodes that are there. And if we solve that equation, we see, and if we call this D then the mean average path length, L, right? Then we see that L should go as log N over log Z, which is kind of, since Z is a constant, this goes as log N, okay? And that's convenient because that's what we understand by a small world, okay? So we speak of a small world in the sense of mean average path length if precisely this mean average path length has an asymptotic behavior of log N, yeah? So for Facebook, for example, we have a billion nodes, roughly, and this is 10 to the 9, and so we expect something in the order of magnitude of 9 as the mean average path length. We know that it's around 6, so this is roughly true. That's why it's O of and not exactly log N, right? And good. So this is very coarse. It's possible to do this more precisely, and the result will roughly be equivalent, okay? So what we see is that obviously with such a random graph model, it is easy to get a small mean average path length. Right. So this is rather for free. So you don't need a P that's too large to produce this desired behavior. Okay. So people might ask themselves, cool, why isn't GNP the whole answer? Why isn't every real world network a Poisson random graph? And the answer is there's naturally other quantities that are not behaving as desired. Okay. So, first of all, what we see is that the degree distribution is Poisson and not power law. So, very many networks are power law networks, not all of them, naturally, but social networks kind of have a comparable degree distribution to a power law, whereas the Poisson function looks roughly like this. So it's rather peaked around some value of K, yeah, that you might expect. So, and the power law would look like this, as we know. Function of K, PK, K, PK, right? So the degree distribution is just not right. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that the clustering coefficient is just not right, okay? Because we know that the clustering coefficient, the first version, is just equal to the probability of transitivity. So the probability that two of your friends are also friends. That's exactly what C1 is. Okay, remember the definition. Now, since in GNP, every edge is drawn independently with the Bernoulli experiment, we know that C1 is exactly equal to P, right? This is just the probability that two of your friends are connected is as probable as any other edge existing, okay, very independently. So, and if Z is fixed, we know that P is O of 1 over N, right? And this for large N, this is very, very small, right? So for Facebook, N 10 to the 9, yeah? So P, quantity C1 is 10 to the minus 9, yeah? 1 billionth, yeah? And that's not what we find, okay? So in the film collaboration network that gave rise to this Kevin Bacon number that I introduced to you, these quantities are in the order of magnitude of 0.79, and that's C2, which is roughly the same as C1, right? And for the nervous system of this worm, we still have 0.28, so that's orders of magnitude larger, okay? And if you have a Poisson random graph with the same number of nodes, yeah, you would get a C of 0.00027. So that's at least 3-4 orders of magnitude smaller than what you really have. Okay. So the mean average path length, they're still okay, right? So the real L is 3.7, whereas the random L would be roughly equal to 3, and that these are comparable quantities, right? Same is true for power grids and other networks, right? But this clustering coefficient is kind of a problem, okay? And naturally, we know that, well, the clustering coefficient, so the tendency of humans to have something like a triadic closure, yeah, so that the probability of two of your friends being friends is considerably larger than for a randomly drawn pair of people. This is only intuitive for social networks, right? Because it reflects the way we socialize. It reflects the way our society is built. It is naturally clustered, okay? We have all sorts of clusters, all sorts of groups. Remember the lecture on groups. We have small groups, families, friend cliques, parties, groups of students, groups of the elderly, all sorts of groups, and they naturally will stick together, okay? That's why these large values for C result. Now, other things that do not match reality very well is that the Poisson random graph has a random mixing pattern, whereas in social network we see assortative mixing patterns. Okay, so remember the example with the races in the U.S. school or the races in marriage, right? Still, unfortunately, groups would stick together. Unfortunately, has to be seen relative in a certain sense, because people strive to kind of distinguish their group from other groups, right? So it's very important to have a relational frame, and this relational frame is just the group structure that you're in. And that reflects the way you dress, the way you kind of do your hair and other things, okay? So everything kind of acts as a way to distinguish you and your group from others. So it's only natural behavior, in a sense, to have assortative mixing, yeah? And in our society, there is some effects of assortative mixing that are not as desirable. For example, in terms of education and equal spread of wealth and so on. So these are things that you have to balance in a certain sense, right? So enforced communism obviously doesn't work out as a system, but well, the opposite also has its disadvantages. That's why we try to balance things in our societies. Another thing is that Poisson random graphs are not navigatable with local search. That's something that we will encounter in the next lecture. And since they don't have a tendency to have a high clustering coefficient, we would not expect, and actually they don't have, a community structure, right? So, and these are all the disadvantages of Poisson random graphs. Now, you could ask yourselves, well, can't we do better than that? Okay, obviously we can. And one thing is the configuration model. And that configuration model kind of replaces this Bernoulli drawing of edges with a prescribed degree distribution. Yeah, and this naturally is a more complicated model. So you require the ensemble to actually have something like a power law or whatever you want. And good. So the results are promising, but still not in perfect congruence with real-world networks. And these things are harder to treat mathematically than these simple Poisson random graphs, right? So, and this, even if you plug in a degree distribution that's power law, you would still not get a high clustering coefficient. Yeah. So even in the configuration model, this remains sort of a mystery. And in fact, it actually was a mystery until 1998, when Duncan Watts and Steve Strogatz came out with their famous small nature paper. So you might know Nature is the most reputed scientific journal in classic science, at least one of them. Yeah, so there's Science, Nature, and others. Yeah. Some, yeah. And not necessarily for computer scientists, but also for computer scientists. So if you happen to have like three Nature papers, then you can assume your post as a full professor somewhere, right? And this is always a great success to have something in there. And what they showed was a way to solve the problem, solve the riddle. And that's the Watts-Strogatz model. And it appears to be very simple. So what you have is you have L nodes, and these L nodes are arranged in a regular D-dimensional lattice. Okay, and this D-dimensional arrangement of these L nodes is also equipped with periodic boundary conditions, right? So periodic boundary conditions, so if you have a 2D grid, for example, yeah? So something like that, yeah? As a 2D grid, and at each grid location you'd have a node, what you would want is that if you leave here, you would start back here, and the same is true if you leave here, you would start back here. So that's what's meant with periodic boundary conditions. Yeah? That's just to eradicate effects that come here from these boundaries, right? It's just, a way to formalize this, okay? And here in that drawing, we would have D equal to 1, right? So D equal to 1 just means that we're having a straight line and nodes at each point. And since we're having periodic boundary conditions, what we have is a ring type of topology, okay? And each node is connected to its neighbors in the lattice at a distance of at most K, right? So here, for example, if we have this kind of grid-like pattern here, or this rectangular simple grid, we know that each node is connected to other nodes at a distance of K equal to 1 only, right? So at a distance of K equal to 2, there is no direct connection, right? And in that case here, the drawing is for D equal to 1 and K equal to 3, right? So if we take this node here, for example, it is connected to this other node, then the node in a distance of 2, as well as the node in a distance of 3, and that's in both directions, okay? So in that case, we're having 6 connections for each node to others, okay? So the total number of edges is then L times K, yeah? Because we just don't want to count each edge twice. That's why it's not 2LK. Now, that's simple, and if you regard a structure like that, what you would have is, if you have something like that, you would produce a high clustering coefficient, but what you would not have is a small mean average path length. Yeah, because on average, if you draw two nodes, the expectation would be that you have at least a way of a fourth of the arc length of this circle to cover, right? So you would just have to go all the steps. There's no possibility to do shortcuts, okay? And that's an observation that they did, that they made. So they came up with a modification of the simple model, which is the resulting Strogatz small world model. And what they have is that they rewire edges with a probability P at random, okay? So you, for each of the edges in this regular grid, you would consider rewiring, okay? And if you actually do have to rewire, yeah, if the Bernoulli experiment turns out to be a success, then you draw another node at random to which you connect, okay? So for example here, this edge that has been previously in the graph was drawn to be considered to be rewired, and this is the other node that was drawn at random to connect, okay? So what we have, regular grid structure and random rewiring. Good. Seems to be cool. So what this means is that still you're having your local connections. So this accounts for the high clustering coefficient. But you can use these shortcuts to efficiently navigate, right? Or not navigate, I should say. But in essence, you small mean average path length exist because of these rewired edges, because you can shortcut to the other side, in coarse words, okay? Good. And what's the effect of this doing, okay? Good. So if P is equal to 0, what we have is this regular lattice, and the clustering coefficient you can calculate if K goes to infinity is 3/4, right? So the clustering coefficient, in a sense, is okay in comparison to real-world networks, but the mean average path length, as I said, is a fourth of the arc length that you would expect to have to cover to any randomly other drawn node, right? So this is certainly not what we want, because if L, the number of nodes, goes to infinity, as in Facebook, for example, if Facebook were such a ring, you would have a very hard time of stepping to some other person. Yeah? So you would require 1/4 of 10 to the 9, roughly, if K is equal to 1. So that is not what we want. That's not a small world effect. For the small world effect, we would want to have something in the order of magnitude log L. Right? And if P is equal to 1, naturally, we would get something like a Poisson random graph, at least something like that. And the clustering coefficient would then, as in the Poisson random graph, go as 1 over L, one of the number of nodes, right? And this is not what we want, because it's very small, but what we have is that L goes as log L as desired, right? So it seems to be at the extreme ends, very, very small P or very, very large P, things are not desirable. But you might have guessed that already. If you regard values of P that are kind of in between, what you get is just the right thing. Okay, so at this diagram, what we have here is on the x-axis, we have the rewiring probability. And on the y-axis, we have two quantities, right? So this is the relative mean average path length, and the other quantity is the relative clustering coefficient, okay? So for very small p, we would have a large clustering coefficient, but for very small p, what we have is a high clustering coefficient, but a small mean average path length, okay? And for a p equal to 1, what we have is a very small clustering coefficient, but an okay mean average path length, right? So obviously what we want to have is a small mean average path length and a large clustering coefficient at the same time. And that's just exactly what we achieve with the right value of P. Okay? And that's why this Watt-Strogatz model was able to explain both things at the same time. Small L and large C. That's just what you want, okay? Now, in comparison to the original model, there are two variants, okay? So first variant is to not only rewire in terms of randomly choosing the new destination for the shortcut, but instead of that, of rewiring both ends, okay? It turns out that this is mathematically easier to treat. We will not regard this. And the second variant is even easier because we don't have rewiring. We just add shortcuts with a certain probability, right? And we'll calculate with this model variant number 2, okay? And for this variant number 2, what we have is that the mean total number of shortcuts is LK times P. That's how this variant 2 is just constructed. And the mean degree of each node is the original 2K that were in the grid base, and 2K times P from this mechanism of adding additional shortcuts, right? Good. So that's important and will become important on the next slides. Okay. And this drawing here has been computed for the second variant. Okay, which is not fundamentally different from the first, but mathematically easier to treat. Okay. Good. If you do the math, and we're not going to do the math, what you find out is that for variant 1, you get this expression for the clustering coefficient, and for variant 2, you would get this clustering coefficient. And if you go with k to infinity, you see that k is in the numerator and in the denominator in the same power, right? So we would expect that if we go with k to infinity, both variants would converge to a constant, okay? And if you compare that with the respective real-world values, you would see that these things are in good congruence, right? So it seems to be the case that with this Watt-Strogatz model, you kind of get an understanding of how these things work, actually, right? Now, let's look at the degree distribution, right? Just to give you an example of how you can do the calculations, okay? So variant 2, remember, it was just having the base grid model and adding shortcuts, no rewiring, okay? So P is defined such that the mean number of added shortcuts is LK times P, right? So you're deciding in a way for each node's edges, whether they should be complemented with a shortcut or various shortcuts or not. And the mean degree is this 2K from the original grid plus 2kp, which is the expectation of this random process adding nodes. Okay. So the number of shortcuts, only these added shortcuts, is binomially distributed. And the expectation of this binomial distribution is L times some other probability. Yeah, and this other probability would then have to be 2kp over L, okay? Because for each node, we'll be having an expected 2kp additional shortcuts. So this p tilde, this fraction would then have to be 2kp over L, okay? Now, what does that binomial distribution look like? Okay, obviously, and here we denote J instead of K. It's just a notational thing, right? So what is the probability of a node having degree J? So since we start from the regular lattice, we know that if J is actually smaller than 2K, this probability is zero, identically zero, because every node starts from its 2K regular edges, right? And that's why we're having this J minus 2K here in this second term of the binomial. And you would, in each instances where in the normal binomial distribution you would have this quantity in question, you would have to subtract 2K to ensure that Pj is zero for j smaller than 2k. So you'd have L over this quantity, you'd have this probability p tilde that we derived, and the quantity, and here we'd have L minus the quantity, right? And here 1 minus p. So this is just a normal binomial distribution, and this is just a way to kind of derive an expression, and then you can do the computations with that. Okay, just to give you an example. In the original model, we would get this result here, which looks a bit more complicated, but in essence, it has the same rough structure in a sense. Yeah, no proof, no derivation, just to state it as such. Okay. Now, if you kind of plot this degree distribution here in the Watt-Strogatz model, you see it's binomially distributed. So what we can do and justifiably do is to approximate this again with the Poisson approximation, this binomial. And if you draw that, for example, for k equal to 3 and p equal to 0.5, what we see is, oops, we're getting a Poisson-like degree distribution again. Yeah, so it's not power law, right? So almost constant, meaning that it's comparatively narrow here, okay? So once again, unfortunately, not in congruence with the real world, because in the real world, we might have things like that. So everything comes at a price, and if you want to explain L and C values correctly, you would earn yourself other things that are not in congruence, right? Now, you might ask yourself, isn't there a universal model that kind of explains it all? Okay. Well, can we expect something like that? No, let's take a step back and think about this. Obviously, friendships, for example, social networks with friendships as edges, right? What are the processes in our society that govern whether someone is a friend of someone else? So we know we kind of have assortative mixing, but that's only one factor. I mean, there is so many other factors that kind of dictate or influence whether you're a friend of somebody else that we can imagine that there is no, or that there's very little chance that we might find a random graph model that kind of explains everything. In essence, finding a random graph model that would explain every property of social networks would be, well, in a sense, the holy grail of sociology, yeah, because you would pack it all into one random graph model, all the sociopsychology, all things like love and interests and hate and everything. And you can imagine this is not likely to happen. So you're always bound to explaining certain things, but at the cost of not explaining others. Okay. If we go back to this image here, this rewired regular graph, in essence, this is really what we find. Okay, so we'd have these groupings, we'd have these local clusters, and the connecting edges between these local clusters are then the shortcuts, right? And I gave you the example of people living in small villages, yeah? So in each small village, everybody knows everybody else, right? But in each village, there's one person that knows people in at least one, let's assume, knows people in other villages. And there's even like the super punk that knows people in the large city 200 kilometers away. Yeah. And these shortcuts allow you to have these small mean path lengths while still retaining your local clustering structure. Okay. And that's this thing, why these things happen. And those of you familiar with peer-to-peer networks and cord-like protocols, we'd have like these exponential routing tables, for example, are just another way to introduce shortcuts to be able to efficiently navigate to content hosted at other nodes at a certain distance, right? So it's not only limited to explaining social networks. These things are also used in peer-to-peer networking protocols. Good. Now, if you're interested in the mean average path length, the calculation is hard. And in fact, at least as I've read here in Newman's papers and other sources, there's no analytic precise solution yet. So there's an approximation that uses some function that goes as x for large x and log x for small x, and a characteristic scale parameter xi, which goes as p to the minus tau for some tau for small p. And L would then be given as this expression here. And this theory, this result, is able to reproduce that for p going to zero, for this regular lattice solution, we'd get L proportional to large L, which is a large world or not a small world. And for p going to 1, it will go as log large L. That's the small one, right? But that's just an approximation, which is kind of limited value for your intuitive understanding, okay? And, well, for the second model, we'll get something that's roughly similar. And there's other approximations that kind of come up with other results, but roughly, things would go as this function that we really want. Good. And also for other dimensions, things are not fundamentally different. We will, in the next lecture, we will investigate Kleinberg's model, which kind of illustrates the effects of dimension a bit more intuitively or more expressively. But in the Watt-Strogatz model, the dimension doesn't change the things fundamentally, right? So if you go from a ring to a grid or a cube, things would be roughly the same. Yeah. Good. So, what we understand, okay, obviously we had three random graph models, and we discussed them in various degrees of detail, right? So the first one was the Poisson random graph. Then we very briefly talked about the configuration model, where you can plug in degree distributions, and the Watt-Strogatz model is a third model, third random graph model for producing networks, right? And each of them has its phenomena that it can explain and other phenomena that it cannot. Okay. Good. However, none of these models really say something about how the network actually has grown from scratch, right? So for the Poisson random graph, all you do is say, okay, I want to have a network with a million nodes, n equal to 10 to the 6, and p I want to have as 0.01, and then I draw the edges, and then I have my network, right? But drawing the edges is nothing like a real growth process of friendships, right? So you don't kind of spread out a million people and then say, okay, mingle, yeah, and then they kind of magically produce the network. This is not what happens. What happens is that somehow people start things like Facebook, you'd have initial users, you have other users coming in, and these other users would have an explicit or implicit heuristic kind of defining who they are likely to connect to. And that's the real growth process. And we might ask ourselves, how does this real growth go about? How does it work? Okay. And in that paper, there are two models that were discussed or are discussed, the model of Price and the very similar model of Barabashi and Albert. Okay. So Price's model has a very simple principle. And this very simple principle is the principle of the rich get richer, right? Which is also something that people refer to as the Matthew effect, with that Bible citation, or which is the more modern designation referred to as preferential attachment. Yeah. So people would connect to other people, or nodes would connect to other nodes that are similar. Similar, for example, with respect to degree or other properties. Okay. Now, Price came up with a model that he intended as an explanation for a citation network. Okay. And in a citation network, the nodes are papers, publications, and each publication cites a number of other publications and, in turn, is cited by other publications, okay? And this is a directed graph, naturally, because I cite you is something different as you cite me, and or paper cites that way. And it is also a tree because of the temporal order, right? So papers are written in time, and that makes it necessarily that you can only cite something in the past and not in the future, right? And future papers could then again cite only things in the past. That's why these things are trees. Good. Now, again, PK is the fraction of nodes. It should read here, not edges, okay? Of nodes with an in degree. Oops, should do the good. Of nodes with an in degree of k. Good. And what we further assume that each paper, each node, has an average out degree of m. Yeah, and that's only natural. If you regard something like a typical IEEE double column paper, what you would have, if it's 8 pages, which is typical, you would have 1 or 2 columns of citations, not three or four pages, and also not two. Yeah, it's typical that for a scientific text that kind of elicitates some phenomenon, we would have roughly a comparable number of citations. Okay, so since the mean out degree in the network must be equal to the mean in degree, right? If there is a citation, then there must be some paper that is cited, right? What we would have is that the expectation sum over k, k, pk must be equal to this average out degree m. Yeah, so that's only logical, right? And Price's model iteratively builds the citation network by adding new papers, new vertices. And the heuristic is that the probability for a paper X to get cited by a new paper is proportional to the number of existing citations of that paper, right? Now, is that realistic? If you write a paper, then naturally what you do is you support your arguments with citations. What kind of choice mechanisms do you employ? So what you would want is you would want to support your arguments with well-reputed papers, right? Because you assume that something that is accepted by many researchers as the truth is more supportive for your argument than something that is not very much endorsed by other researchers, right? So you would want to have citations of papers that are in turn highly cited. Okay, and that's the justification of this principle by which new nodes that come in choose their nodes that they build edges to, right? So you would, if you're new, you would build edges to papers that have a high in degree, that are well cited by other papers. Okay. Naturally, this causes a slight difficulty. Because if you're new and you're not having any citations, and if other nodes that come in choose the papers that they are going to cite, they have a probability of zero choosing you because your citations are still zero. That's why we need to introduce something like a starting grant, and Price kind of said that in a sense every paper cites itself by kind of suggesting that it should appear, right? If a paper is accepted, then you can say, well, it's something like a self-citation. Yeah, at least the author of the paper thinks that this is not crappy shit. So we will start with a initial degree of one, right? That's why in all these calculations we have this plus one here, okay? Now, the probability that a new edge attaches to any node with an in degree k, yeah, is proportional to this degree, plus one because of this, and it's also proportional to the fraction of nodes that actually have this degree k. Yeah? So this probability is proportional to k and proportional to pk. And this is just the normalization. Yeah? So the probability that a new edge attaches to any node within degree k is given by this expression, right? And since we know from the previous slide that sum over k, k, pk is equal to m, meaning that someone must cite something, and if you cite something, there must be something that is cited. Yeah, we can simplify this in the denominator by inserting this equation. Right, so that's the expression we would want. Okay, good. So, and since we know that on average, each paper cites m other papers, what we then know is that the mean number of new in edges to a node that has a current in degree k is just given by that probability times m. Okay? So that's the mean number X of new in edges that are kind of available for nodes with current in degree K. Okay, good. So what happens? So we're having a network of citations with nodes that have different degrees and so on, and that's a static network. Now a new node comes in, right? What will happen? Okay. So since this new paper has M citations to deal out, yeah, things change in the graph, okay? So the mean number of nodes with an in degree K decreases by that X because their in degree is now changed to K plus 1, right? So I'm a paper with an in degree of K. The new paper comes in and cites me, okay? Now I have a new degree of K plus 1, and I'm out of the number of edges with degree K, because I'm now K plus 1. I'm a bit more reputated, right? So I'm good. So what we already see is that there is some dynamical process going on, right? So this mean number of nodes with in degree K is naturally N times PK. That's just the expectation that we already know, right? So transferring this bullet point here to the next slide, yeah, is there another process going on? So the mean number of nodes with in degree K decreases because of citations, but it also increases. Why? Because previously, if I were a node having an in degree of K minus 1, and the new paper cites me, now I have an in degree of K, right? Which positively contributes to the number of nodes with degree K, yeah? So what you have is kind of a balance equation, right? So the net change in this quantity NPK, which is the expected number of nodes with a degree K, this net change is just given by this expression, right? So N changes from N to N plus 1 because we're having the new paper inside. Previously, we had N papers. Now we have N plus 1, right? And so N plus 1 times PK for a graph with N plus 1 nodes is the expected number of vertices after adding the new paper, and NPK, N is the expected number of vertices with degree K, of course, before adding the new paper, right? And this net change has these two factors. The first one is the decrease factor, and the second one is increase factor, okay? So the increase factor comes from nodes that previously had K minus 1, right? And the decrease factor comes from nodes that had previously PK, right? Just according to the logic of these two sentences. And since we know that this mean number of edges is given by that expression, so with this m over m plus 1, and always these terms proportional to k and proportional to pk, what we have is proportional to k and pk, k and pk, and this m over m plus 1 factor here in every of these expressions, right? And these are just the formalizations of this, okay? Now the decrease, now the new degree is K plus 1, right? The increase and the new degree would be K. Previously it was K minus 1, now it's K. Previously it was K, now it's K plus 1. And that's the net change, yeah? And for K equals 0, we get this special version of this equation, which is kind of simple, right? Now, this is a kind of, recursion equation, which you can solve with your knowledge from discrete Strukturen or something. And what we find is if we compute the stationary solutions, right? So when nothing changes anymore, on average, if we keep on adding, right? What we find is that Pk would then be k to the minus, 2 plus 1 over m for large n, right? So since m is a constant, we would find k to the minus some constant. And that's just the power law, right? Good. So the insight is that in Price's model, which is just the formalization of the rich get richer, and the the more beautiful get more beautiful is not right. However, the reputated scientific opinions become more stable over time, which is not a good thing, right? So maybe you remember stories from science history where new and revolutionary insights had problems being accepted just because of that mechanism. It's always safer for a young scientist to cite established opinions than to rely on new and revolutionary ideas, right? So he was asking for an example for that. Can I imagine something like that? Is it with relativity theory? Well, maybe you could take the early stages of quantum theory, for example, right? Because at the end of the 19th century, people would give the advice to young students not to study physics anymore, because in essence, everything was solved, right? People know classical mechanics, classical electrodynamics, classical fluid dynamics, and these were all continuous classical deterministic theories, right? And then the only difficulty was that some phenomena would not be accounted for by these simple theories, right? So, for example, the black body radiation formula that was experimentally determined could not be explained by classical electrodynamics, right? It could only be explained if you accepted quantum physics as the underlying process, quantum electrodynamics. And I presume that, which I don't know precisely, that people would still try to cite some kind of obscure papers that might have dissolved in the vaults of science that kind of tried to explain these things with whatever arguments, because they relied on classical electrodynamics as the only explanation, right? And these revolutionary new people kind of dealing with quantum mechanics, I guess they had their difficulties in terms of being cited, right? I cannot be more precise, yeah, but there may be more clear examples for that. Yeah, if you want, consider the Earth as a disk, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Und da ist das oftmals so ein Argument, immer wieder stoße ich halt darauf, weil man das, die Wissenschaft ist eigentlich relativ gut darin, neue Ideen zu akzeptieren, wenn die Daten gesammelt werden. Es hat ein bisschen Zeit gedauert, bis die Quantenphysik angekommen ist, aber wenn es angekommen ist, dann ist es so,
For sure. Your arguments, I mean, if science is conducted in a proper way, yeah, then it should not play a role how many people actually cite something, but whether there's an internal truth in something. But classical science or math doesn't have that problem in that particular form that extremely, right? Because you'd have the experiment or you have mathematical proofs to kind of support your point of view, right? But things that are more relative, that are more laden with interpretations and stuff, I think there the effect is stronger. I mean, I don't claim that this is a severe fundamental problem in science. I mean, as you say, if there is a new theory that kind of gives logical arguments, people are willing to accept it because they kind of reflect the content. But here we don't have a content. We have just the statistics and the principles, right? And this principle would, in essence, give people a hard time. Yeah, and that's true for social phenomena. If you are new to a city, or if you're new to a club, or new to some other social circle, you're always having a problem because people would kind of assume that you're not very socially fit if you don't have any friends, and thus they would not befriend you. And if you start with having a lot of friends, then adding new ones is quite easy. And that's a phenomenon that you can easily do in experiments. If you go to any social venue, yeah, a club or a bar or something, and if you stay alone, if you come alone and stay, you will stay alone, right? That's only logical. And if you come with two or three persons, the probability that you get to know others is way higher. You know? So that's why people keep on suggesting that if you're trying to be new to a social circle, the first thing that you should do is try to quickly attach to persons that are highly socialized themselves, right? That's only the true recipe that people use. Now, what we see is that with this simple preferential attachment type of growth model by Price, we can explain the power law degree distribution. And that has become, at least a rough accepted opinion that this is the underlying phenomenon generating power laws. Okay. And Albert's and Barabashi's model is roughly the same as the one by Price. It uses undirected edges, okay? And what they do is they take nodes with a fixed degree of M and add them to the network at each iteration, right? And the edges, again, are connected to nodes with probability proportional to the current degree, right? So that's roughly the same, but with undirected edges and a slightly different process. And an analogous analysis leads to the fact that we get P as K to the minus 3 for large N. Okay, so comparable results. And however, there's also cons to this model. So the undirected edge type is certainly not something that is very typical of, for example, the web, because in the web you clearly have one page citing another, which implies nothing about the cited page citing the original, right? So we have directed edges in these networks, and they're an integral part of the semantics, right? So you might be tempted to solve or heal this by saying that the attachment is proportional to the sum of out and in degree, but what would that mean for the web, for example? Yeah, and it's also maybe not very realistic for social networks as well, right? So the social value of a person, if you want to be very mechanistic, right, is defined by how many people like this person and not by how many people this person likes, or the sum of both, right? Good. There's also downsides or cons for Price's model. As I said, it generates a tree, in essence, an acyclic graph, which is not typical for a social network, right? And good. So there are several things that are not really true, right? And what's also not necessarily true is that both of these models crucially rely on linear preferential attachment of the sort that we described, right? So in essence, once again, there are models that kind of explain something, but no model explains everything, right? So, in the next lecture, we'll be closing this kind of treatment of real-world networks with processes on networks, right? That's something I wanted to do today, but okay, do it next time. Processes are, for example, disease spreading. Yeah, how do diseases spread? I mean, what does it have to do with the architecture of the network? And another phenomenon is, for example, percolation. In terms of stability, what happens if you take away nodes or edges? And the third one is about searching, right? So we'll revisit PageRank, and we'll be very, very briefly discussing an alternative model that kind of regards the direction of edges. Yeah? Presumably, Google is doing something like that, but we don't know what's in there. Large data vaults and their large processors. Okay. So see you next week next week on Tuesday. I don't know if there's a lecture. Is it Pfingsten? Sorry. It's a holiday. Yeah. So next Tuesday, no lecture, but on Wednesday again. I'm so sorry. I hate it myself, and thanks for attending, and we'll be back on next Wednesday, right? See you. Nice holidays. Oops.